Take a network break, grab a virtual donut, and join us for a review and analysis of this week's tech news. We've got stories today on new products from Arista and Cisco, acquisition updates, and a little conversation on business ethics. Today's episode is sponsored in part by Cumulus Networks. They're announcing a brand new networking certification, the Cumulus Certified Open Networking Professional. You'll learn Linux networking fundamentals and become proficient in Cumulus Linux. To find out more, go to cumulusnetworks.com/cert. Today's show is also sponsored in part by ExtraHop, the enterprise cyber analytics company delivering performance and security from the inside out. ExtraHop offers complete visibility with machine learning to help you make quick, confident decisions about your IT environment. You can explore the ExtraHop performance platform at extrahop.com/packetpushers. And this is just a reminder to check out ignition.packetpushers.net. It's our premium site with exclusive content, including white papers, automation blogs, training videos, and more. Greg, you've been doing more writing there as well.
Yeah, I've been getting focused on ancillary issues, not like non-core. It's not training. I've been writing about the potential impact of artificial intelligence and machine learning, talking about DNS over H. So sort of forward-looking issues, and that's what I'll keep delivering into Ignition. It's the sort of issues that we discuss here, but taking it a bit deeper and expanding them into a, well, when you write 3,000 to 5,000 words on something, you tend to do a lot deeper thought and you tend to research it a bit more heavily. And then I end up with about a whole page of references for you to go and do your own research in a company to see if what I wrote was actually good and valid. So you can make your own decision.
Yes,
I'm not here to tell you how
check his work. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'll give you some ideas of what I thought and then put all my work there. And then you can go out and have a look at it and see if you agree with what I've said or not. And then hopefully you'll feedback if you don't. And I can either agree or disagree and update if it's wrong. Wrong is bad. That's the most thing.
Absolutely. And in the background, Ethan and I are working with some folks on new content. We'll have some video training on Ansible and some other things coming soon. So keep an eye out for that. Ignition is $99 a year. You can subscribe at ignition.packetpushers.net. All right, let's talk some news. Arista Networks has announced a new version of CloudVision. That's the company's management, monitoring, and analytics software for its wired and wireless devices. The big thing is CloudVision, you know, they already collect streaming telemetry from Arista devices. They've opened that up to third-party devices. If that device supports OpenConfig, they can pull config that way, or they have an SDK that runs an SNMP collector, so they can pull SNMP data from third-party devices. That means Cisco, Juniper, Checkpoint, Fortinet, etc.
Mm-hmm. But more importantly, Sonic and things like that. I think increasingly, if I was running a network today, I might run Arista in some places of my network and then run a white box with the Sonic operating system on it in others. And this allows me to pick and choose the hardware I want, but I still need an SDN controller to sit across the top. And then maybe CloudVision would be that controller for you. I think that's a very important part about this opening up to use standards.
Yeah, I think so. And I don't know if they're positioning CloudVision quite as a controller yet. It's more their management and monitoring plane, but they do say you can leverage it to do things like build workflows where you can execute a bunch of scripts to do config changes, software updates, et cetera. So it does seem to be moving in that direction, even though they haven't quite positioned it there yet.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in the notes here, I said is, you know, Arista said, here's the challenges of network operations. I'm going like, hello, 2015. it's a bit well behind where the competitive position. So if you look at, say, other SDN platforms in this space, like Cisco's ACI or VMware's NSX, those, of course, are very different products, but they're much more advanced in terms of telemetry, analytics, sideways integration. You know, ACI has partnerships with, I want to say dozens, but it's probably a handful of companies, well-known IT, enterprise IT companies that snap into ACI in some level. They're not fully integrated. They're mostly, at best, partially integrated. But, you know, you get the idea. So for Arista, I think, really coming from behind, probably maybe as much as 5 years behind, can they get there? You know, would I consider this to be a viable strategy? Yes, I think Arista's demonstrated a really good talent for software. And they've been growing very hard, shipping more and more switches, adding more and more ASICs to their suite and so forth. It wouldn't have made sense for them to get into SDN any earlier than this. I think that's a pretty thin argument, but I think they wanted to focus on the switches and they've been forced into SDN. So I still get the sense this is a grudging commitment to SDN. They would much rather just sell the switches.
Yeah, I think it's part of their move into campus. They acquired Mojo Wireless to get into campus. Yeah. They've released new switches that they call splines to run in the campus. And now these days, if you're going to be in the campus, you need to have some kind of management and automation plane to centralize all of the work you have to do. CloudVision ties directly into that. And by bringing in third-party devices, they're also acknowledging that they know they're not going to be the only vendor in the campus, but they want to be that visibility and monitoring platform for you there.
The interesting thing is they're talking about one CloudVision for all use cases. So campus and data center and multi-cloud will all be one controller. And perhaps if they, by coming to market later, they're not going to fall down the trap that other vendors have done, which is to have a different tool for each area.
Yes.
You know, back when SD-WAN was seen as hard, so you start up a division and now, or increasingly, and as we'll talk about down further in the show, Cisco ACI is now integrating with Viptela SD-WAN to unify. And of course, that means now you've got two controllers, two completely different software platforms, and the integration between those is much more difficult. Whereas if Arista gets CloudVision right and then goes down the pipe, I mean, it does place Arista somewhere buying an SD-WAN company in the future, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I can see that.
Maybe they could turn EOS to SD-WAN functions, but I don't know. Maybe they can, maybe they can't. We'll see what they decide to do as time goes by. I mean, they don't have to buy.
They could certainly buy someone cheap.
Yeah, I think there's plenty of SDN companies, SD-WAN companies out there who that they could use to kickstart their footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but I think they would much rather build up their cognitive management plane. So I still, you know, my feeling on coming up with your own language for these things.
Yes, I know.
Arista continues to have its cognitive management plane instead of just like software management or SDN. They've always got to give it their own name, splines and all that sort of stuff, which is kind of interesting because, you know, if you're an Arista customer, you have to learn how to speak Aristaese mm-hmm. to communicate with them. Otherwise, they're not going to talk to you because every Arista employee who speaks publicly always speaks in Arista's language, which is kind of frustrating. I don't know if you've noticed that.
They do have their own way of talking and their own, yeah, there is kind of their own insular language there. And I take your point about Arista kind of moving late into this market, but I also, my impression of Arista is that they move very deliberately. They are not trend hoppers, which in some ways is a good thing. And so they are coming very deliberately into this campus market with CloudVision, as you say, a multi-domain singular visibility and management system, campus, data center, cloud.
I like that idea. I like that stitching of that together. And they seem to be, as you say, making deliberate steps. I'm just making the point that they're 5 years later than everybody else, maybe longer.
VMware, Cisco, Juniper all have a march on them, both in terms of product and messaging.
Well, it's also true that a lot of companies are still not deployed SDN. We're still very short on adoption, less than 10%, I would think.
Yep.
You know, in terms of actual networks that are now being managed by software, probably less than 5% when all is said and done. So it's not necessarily too late to enter the market in that
sense. Not at all. Not at all.
I felt that CloudVision is a pretty, you know, it's going to be easy for them to decide what to chase and what to do. Like, for example, choosing to do Ansible integration with CloudVision makes sense because the only framework really that networking engineers are using is Ansible. You don't have to worry about Chef and Puppet so much these days.
Right. That's one of the integrations in this new version of CloudVision. They work with Ansible.
Yes, which is fine. You know, there are people out there puppetizing and chefing their infrastructure, but not very many. Most people are sticking with Ansible, and that's where we're sort of standing on. And their ability to focus their product on, you know, what is actually a real requirement instead of picking where the winners are is going to be, in a sense, catching up is going to be much easier than trying to make the running.
Absolutely. A couple other new elements with the CloudVision. They can now ingest IPFIX and S-Flow for monitoring and analytics, and they provide topology overlays, which is essentially a visual overlay of your network topology, but you can hover over a device and get some information about its configuration and state in that topology view.
Notably, no AI, just cognitive analytics, which I thought was rather good. Again, we've seen CloudVision announce various pieces of analytics over the last 2 or 3 years. Like when CloudVision first came out, it was an analytics and a change control, like a configuration automation. I see the positioning now says we're here to help you with change control and compliance and risk. So they're going to go and watch for switch configs, watch the configuration of the devices on the network. And that's an expansion on the original, you know, configuration. Once you've got the configuration in a database, well, it's not too hard to make an app that does compliance checking, you know?
Exactly.
And once you're starting to pull data, then turning it into analytics isn't particularly hard. The addition of real-time telemetry is important because the concept of temporal state is very key to the way we're going forward. We can't regard the network as a fixed, unchanging thing anymore. It has to be regarded as an amorphous, adaptive, reactive type of environment. So telemetry gives you the real-time state, you know?
Exactly.
You want to know if the switch reboots and this happens over here. You want to know and be able to correlate those two facts together. So
yeah, for sure.
That link is running at 70% of utilization, then and there's a switch reboot, then there's a reason, right? Mm-hmm. So that's mm-hmm. the sort of stuff you're looking for.
All right, moving on. Cisco has updated Cloud ACI and its APIC controller to run in Azure public clouds. They already have a version of APIC that can run in AWS. A couple of highlights here. APIC runs natively in Azure. APIC is going to use Azure native APIs to provision Azure resources, including VNet and also Cisco's CSR 1000V cloud router. It creates an IPsec VPN as the underlay between your premises data center and Azure clouds, and that's using EVPN and VXLAN as the overlay. Customers can cloud burst from on-prem to Azure and share resources like DNS, Active Directory, firewalling, et cetera, between premises and the cloud.
You know, the ACI product continues to evolve. Cisco continues to, you know, extend its tentacles in all sorts of different directions, mm-hmm. as many as possible, because it seems to be doing all things to all people. Support for Azure seems to be a bit late in the cycle, I think. I would have thought that ACI would have had Azure cloud support by now, but Azure is sort of almost like really the default cloud for enterprises, but yet most of the vendors have supported AWS first, which I've never quite understood. There's sort of like a magic field around AWS that everybody wants to
be. It's a black hole, yes, that sucks everyone into it, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's good. Extending the EVPN underlay from your data into Azure is right. But I think the key thing here is that Cisco will now let you put the APIC controller inside of Azure itself instead of having it on-prem, which just lets you have deployment flexibility around the way that you want to work. And obviously, if you want to have an Azure only, you know, if you're going to run a mono cloud, then having that stuff in the Azure might give you something. Quite why you'd use ACI on top of Azure, I wouldn't alone, wouldn't make much sense to me. I don't see the value in that. But I think the second part of this announcement, which was that they're integrating the Viptela SD-WAN to ACI microsegmentation. So they're stitching the segments together between the two. And that was very interesting. Something I've been banging on with for the last, I don't know, month or two. Mm-hmm. And saying that, you know, we need to see where the SD-WAN can stitch to the data center segmentation, to the campus segmentation. And I think I also flagged at the time that Cisco is really the one company that's well positioned to do all of that. And they're going to leverage that monopoly sort of, we do all the things, one brand, one home, and really twist customers' arm to say, you know, it could be risky if you got different vendors and tried to stitch them together. I don't think it would be risky. I think it's very easy, but they're going to, by playing this card early, they're going to say to customers, you need just one vendor. You should be mono vendor with us all the way through.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm actually surprised that Cisco's taken this long to stitch SD-WAN into ACI, given that NSX VMware has already been positioning NSX and their own VeloCloud doing that same combination. So Cisco is sort of chasing here a little bit. But mm. but I agree, they're going to position this as you can be all Cisco, soup to nuts, end to end.
Yeah. And one of the things to be aware of here is I'd be careful about heading down this path. Cisco has a habit of announcing these things, and then what comes out at the other end isn't actually all that great, and they take a number of years to get it right historically. And I think ultimately SD-WAN and campus segmentation, I think data center and campus segmentation can be quite tightly bound together. They're the same thing. And I think Cisco might have made a mistake with Lisp and having a completely different underlying technology than mm-hmm. the data center that should have had the same. But mm-hmm. that said, you know, I think SD-WAN and data center segmentation are going to be like Microsoft Word and Microsoft Excel. They're in the same suite, and they interoperate at some level, but they aren't, you know, pin-for-pin compatible, totally integrated. They do different things. And the integration point is going to be kind of naff. You might be able to steer traffic. I mean, you might be able to steer traffic from one micro segment into a, you know, from a Viptela segment into a data center segment, but the cost settings won't work for a couple of years or things like that.
Yeah, this is in contrast to Arista moving deliberately. Cisco tends to announce first and then figure it out as they go.
Yeah, they don't want customers leaving away. They want to take up the customer's attention, thinking about these new features and putting them on their roadmaps. And that way, the customer never looks anywhere else and doesn't need to look outside the box, mm-hmm. don't need to reevaluate their strategy. A lot of customers have a Cisco-only strategy, and that's worked well for them for a long period of time. It's an expensive way of doing business, but hey, it's not your money, so it's perfectly viable as far as I'm concerned.
All right, chipmaker Marvell has completed its purchase of Aquantia, which makes multi-gig transceivers, particularly targeted automotive networking. The acquisition was announced back in May. Marvell spent $452 million to buy up Aquantia shares.
Yeah, Aquantia was a big maneuver behind the 2.5 5 gig movement. And then once that got over the hump, they started to move down into the new 100 meg 1 gig used for cars. I didn't put anything in the show notes this week, but the Ethernet Alliance is pushing hard on their automotive Ethernet and their 100 meg over one pair, or even one cable, I think, at some places. So Aquantia is one of those companies that mastered that. that whole automotive technology thing is seen as a growth market for a lot of these chip makers. So if you don't have a networking silicon that can be used in cars, and it is a special type of silicon that goes in cars, it needs to be hardened and have a different power type of consumption than what enterprises use. It needs almost no features, you know, that sort of stuff. I think the second part of this is that Aquantia is much more of a transceiver maker. So they don't make Ethernet switching silicon or NIC silicon. They make the transceiver that goes in there. And we recently saw Cisco make an acquisition in that space. We know that Mellanox already made an acquisition 5 or 6 years ago in that space. And I think there's a shift here as we move away from 10 gig to 25 gig. But for those companies who are running 25 gig, they're probably running NRZ encoding today, or Z as I would say, and they're shifting to PAM4. So as you shift up to pulse amplitude modulation 4, like there's a 4-layer PAM signaling going on, that'll get you up to 100 gig and 400 gig, but that requires a shift in the internal ASICs. And I think the companies have decided that they want to have that technology in-house. So Marvel's got its chipset, its ASICs, and it's going to have its transceiver capabilities, and it's going to work hard to make sure that it's got those capabilities bonded together, maybe as they can sell the whole turnkey solution. Even though the transceivers are interchangeable, they want to have that business in-house to drive scale and production volumes.
Right. Yes. And definitely, the potential for the automotive market to take off in terms of self-driving cars, The potential is big. Whether it actually pans out that way, we'll see. But Marvel is positioning itself for the future.
Cars are going to be copper, but the future for Ethernet, especially in the telco, is optical. And even for enterprise IT, it's also optical. So the transceiver market is shifting down to low-speed specialist cabling, but also up into optical at the other. And those market transitions change the way silicon is made and also the way your ASICs, like we're seeing switching ASICs actually have to support PAM4 and NRZ encoding so that any transceiver can work. And in the long term, it'll just be PAM4 as we make that transition, and that will reduce the cost of silicon going forward. So the gearboxes and the SerDeses all get a lot easier when you just have one encoding.
All right, let's pause for a short message from one of today's sponsors, Cumulus Networks. Did you know that in 2019, there are probably more than 100 IT networking certification credentials? So why is Cumulus launching another one? Because what's out there doesn't address open, standard, Linux-based switching and infrastructure networking. Cumulus believes that open networking is inevitable, so the company built a training and certification program to prepare engineers for the future. You can take your networking skills up a notch and become a true solutions architect in open systems by becoming a Cumulus Certified Open Networking Professional, or CCONP. So what's in the program? You're going to learn Linux networking fundamentals, including essential concepts and commands behind Linux-based open networking. You'll also learn the Cumulus Core. That's everything you need to know to become proficient in Cumulus Linux. And of course, you'll be ready to take the Certified Open Networking Professional exam to become CCONP certified. And the first 100 to earn the cert will get exclusive swag from Cumulus. If you want to learn more about the program and get started, head to cumulusnetworks.com/cert. That's cumulusnetworks.com/cert. And just a heads up, Cumulus wrote about its program on Packet Pushers. So if you want even more detail, go to packetpushers.net and search for the State of Networking Certifications. We thank Cumulus for being a sponsor. All right, back to the news. Bloomberg's reporting that Cisco offered more than $7 billion to acquire the startup Datadog ahead of its recent IPO. Datadog makes APM software to instrument applications and monitor code dependencies. Datadog rebuffed Cisco's offer and raised $648 million in its IPO on its own.
Yeah, that $648 million values it at $6.8
billion. Yes.
So it doesn't appear to have lost out. Now, I think the key here is that it's quite normal for companies to make offers to buy other companies, and it's quite normal for them to be rebuffed. There's a whole incestuous sort of industry of people running around having meetings with each other. So anytime you want to make a statement that company is talking to company then with confidence, it's probably true because they probably all have talked to each other at some point. So this isn't surprising. Cisco does have a history, however, of rocking up on a Friday morning and making an unsolicited offer and saying, hey, we want to buy your company. Here's our take it or leave it offer. And they literally just put an offer on the table and they say, you've got until Monday morning to say yes or no. If you don't take it by Monday morning, we're out of here.
We're going to leave this suitcase full of $7 billion here. If it's gone when we come back, we've got a deal.
And it becomes a becomes a real decision then. Do you, crunch decision? And because you have to do it, and they've always stuck to, if you don't take it, they just walk away. They'll never come back. Mm-hmm. And they've got a reputation for that. So that some people see that as a way to pick up companies on the cheap. Because if you walk in with a, bucket full of cash and say, we're going to buy your company pretty much outright, or for Cisco shares, which is pretty much close to cash these days, you know, in reasonable terms. And they said, no, we're going to go for an IPO. So that would have been a really brave decision. It would have been a big decision to make, to walk away from an instant payout. But a lot of these people who run these companies do get rather full of themselves, as we know. Mm-hmm. So it's also possible that they looked carefully at what happens post-Cisco acquisition. And Cisco has recently started building up its own internal venture capital arm. And the people who are the founders of the companies that it acquires suddenly appear in that VC organization. Mm-hmm. So the usual thing is that, you know, when you acquire a company, the founder comes along, spends a couple of years sitting around having a getting the company integrated, making sure that everything goes pretty well. But pretty much they stop, you know, a year in, they're on a break. And by the end of the second year, when they're earning out, they're drinking coffee in a coffee shop 5 days a week. I think Cisco might be offering some terms where they actually restrict the founders and put them into make sure they don't leave the company. I think Cisco wants to make sure that they get a hold of these people and force them into a lifestyle, the Cisco lifestyle, which, you know, some people love and some people don't. And there doesn't seem to be too many of them walking out the door these days. So if you're a founder of a company and you looked at that, you'd go like, I have to buy today and then I'm committing the rest of my life to being inside of Cisco. Is that something I want? 7 billion reasons to say yes, but, you know, I could go on IPO and stay in control of my destiny and still make even more money. And that looks like what Datadog has done, and they've done well.
Yeah, so far. I was sort of curious about why Cisco would want Datadog, given that they are so focused on application performance monitoring. There's not even really a networking component here. It's all about code dependencies and what libraries are being used and tracing right down to actual customer requests deep inside the application. And then I remember that Cisco acquired AppDynamics back in 2017 for about half the amount they offered Datadog. So I guess they've got an interest here, but it seemed like not necessarily the best fit for Datadog.
Yeah, I agree. It seems a bit... Datadog is much more about cloud monitoring, multi-cloud monitoring, so it might have something. Or maybe it's also quite possible that AppDynamics is not cutting it for Cisco.
That's also what I wondered, because if you look at what AppDynamics and the way it positions itself, it's almost identical to Datadog. So
I think AppDynamics was much more about embedding your analytics inside of your app. So as you write your code, you embed it in there, and it was very focused on that. It was less of an infrastructure play. Mm-hmm. Whereas my understanding is that Datadog is much more of an infrastructure play. So it's much more about monitoring, you know, your Kubernetes and your containers. It does have some app monitoring, or some RUM monitoring, as they call it.
Yep.
But I think it might be much more focused on things like serverless and networking and so on and so forth. So maybe there's less of an overlap than is immediately obvious. But then again, you might need to be an expert to tell the difference.
Right.
But, you know, maybe AppDynamics lost its momentum after Cisco acquired it and they didn't know what to do with it and they need to revitalize. I mean, Cisco needs to be in this space. A little hard to tell at this distance because we don't focus on that market, but it's certainly possible. Cisco's acquisition, you know, success rate is never 100%. Anybody's acquisition success rate is not 100%.
No, not at all.
And Cisco's is not all that great either, so maybe it is. Their AppDynamics isn't working out and they need to boost it, perhaps. Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. Datadog believed in itself and decided to go forward with the IPO and had a pretty good one. And as you mentioned, the valuation is around now $7 billion, which is about where Cisco came in. So I guess well done, Datadog, and we'll see how it goes with them.
Yeah, somebody like New Relic might be waiting for a knock on the door this Friday.
Right.
There's plenty of others in that space that Cisco could buy if it wants to.
There are. All right, moving on. Google has pledged to spend 3 billion euros over the next 2 years to boost its data center footprint in Europe. This is according to a story in Reuters. 600 million of those euros are targeted toward building a new data center in Finland that will complement an existing site in the same area. Google also has data centers in Belgium, the Netherlands, and Ireland.
So this is almost directly a reaction to the year breakdown between the USA and Europe in terms of data integrity and privacy. Google had been fairly persistent in saying, we have no intention in building out infrastructure in Europe under any circumstances, just a few years ago. Do you remember those?
I do not, frankly, no.
No, they pretty much made it clear they were not interested in making an investment in mainland Europe. They were going to put some data centers in Ireland for a few bits and pieces, but otherwise not interested in doing that at all. And then since the Germans came up and said, you have to place German data in Germany, that's now becoming the standard default privacy regulation for all the countries here. And so 3 billion euros is basically catch-up money here. Google should have been putting data centers in Europe years ago, but they chose to fight the regulators, and this is now a sort of a reactive move before the governments literally legislate and say, you know, make it much worse than it has to be. So not a big deal. I don't think this is Google pledging anything, or it should not be rewarded for this. It should be recognized as the bare minimum it could do.
Yeah, and frankly, for data center investment, $3 billion is, you know, not that big a number.
No, not a whole lot. And at this point, you know, Google has to, you think about the real estate cost alone, that's going to be like $1.5 to $2 billion just buying the land.
Just buying the land.
You know, yeah. So it's not a whole lot, no.
All right, moving on. Last week, we had talked about a couple of penetration testers who were arrested after breaking into an Iowa courthouse. The pen testers believed that physical penetration was in scope. The police did not. Now, Ars Technica is reporting that the contract with the assessment company did, in fact, include lockpicking and physical entry in the contract. And the arrest apparently was the result of confusion between county and state employees. The pen testers have been released on bail but still face charges.
You know, we covered this last week, and this is, you know, left hand meets right hand. Never having known each other before sort of thing. And when I listened in and read up on some more of this thing, this seems to be exactly what's happened. The penetration testing contract came out of the court system, and the actual physical asset is administered by a police force. And if you've ever worked inside of the legal system, you might find that the police don't get along very well with the courts, who don't get along very well with the jails, who don't get along very well with the police. They all regard themselves as doing the best job, and the other people are always mucking it up for them or something like that. It's kind of this, you know, when provoked, they'll bond together, but when not, they sort of fight with each other.
The whole time. Turf battles, like, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, you would know, everybody knows a situation like that. And this is what it looks like. You know, the police decided to arrest him. And when he realized that the court system was doing something that the police didn't know about, they went like, we're going to make an example. We're going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
It feels like it, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think last week I mentioned that it seemed to me like, you know, somebody on the Iowa side, whether the county or the state, didn't really read the contract or understand what they were getting into. It seems like that may be the case. There may have been a lack of miscommunication among these various agencies about what was going on. And these poor pen testers sort of got caught up in it. My hope is that if this goes to court, that a judge is going to recognize that these folks were acting in good faith with a contract that allowed them to do what they did. So hopefully, you know, they won't end up in jail.
If you want to cut up rough, you're going to be in a situation where this person says, well, your department doesn't have control over my department.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to make an example out of, you know.
Right, yeah.
It's petty politics. But
it really is, yeah. But in the meantime, you've got two people caught in the middle here who were in jail.
Any bureaucracy. I've had exactly the same sort of stuff inside of corporate companies, you know, where somebody ran a pen test program but didn't, you know, the branch, let's just say it was an institution that has a substantial number of branches in the financial industry. And somebody did a pen test, and the part of the pen tester was it walked into the branch and started to, you know, just walked into the back and it started, picked up some of the routers and walked out of the building. And the person in charge of the branch network just absolutely just went bananas. They said, you should have told me, and blah, 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 as if they weren't part of the same company. You know?
Right.
Same thing happening.
Yes, yes.
But when, you know, this is why you never work for lawyers, never get involved with lawyers, never get involved with the law, because it's the word of the law ultimately that gets you, not the spirit of the law.
Yeah, so we'll keep an eye on this and see how it plays out. A quick break to tell you about one more sponsor today, ExtraHop. They're the enterprise cyber analytics company delivering performance and security from the inside out. IT and network operations teams are responsible for managing the applications and infrastructure that modern enterprises depend on. But SDN, cloud, and shadow IT create blind spots, especially when it comes to applications that can't be instrumented. ExtraHop is a leader in network analytics. They help IT teams like yours rise above the noise of tool sprawl and enterprise complexity. They offer complete visibility with machine learning to help you make quick, confident decisions about your environment. You can explore the ExtraHop performance platform at extrahop.com/packetpushers. That's extrahop.com/packetpushers. All right, for the last section of the show, there may be some politics involved, so here's your trigger warning if you want to bail.
They're all technology related.
But it is technology related, yes. There is a reason we're talking about it.
And as always, we take a partisan view. We just raise the issues to let you make your own mind up.
All right, so the first story is Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos has pledged that the e-commerce giant will be carbon neutral by 2040 and will run on 100% renewable energy by 2030. This announcement came ahead of a planned strike by some Amazon workers as part of a global climate action day on Friday, September 20th. So as part of the plan, Jeff Bezos said the company is going to purchase 100,000 electric delivery vans, purchasing them from a startup that Amazon itself has invested in.
Can I be like really cynical here?
I would expect nothing else.
This really feels like they're kicking the can down the road. So they're saying in 2019, they'll be carbon neutral by 2040. That's 20 years away.
Yep.
And all the science points to, you know, we need to be doing stuff at the latest by 2025 and we'll know by 2035 whether that humanity will exist, right? So we can argue over the years, but basically, you know, if it goes backwards or forward. So Amazon really isn't putting in a big effort here. The initial reaction would be like, oh, that's not bad. You know, like even these delivery vans, 100,000 delivery vans, the deliveries won't start for 2 years and they'll all be on the roads by 2024, maybe, you know, like I want to say, yeah, like it's an announcement, but I think we really need to be in a situation where we don't reward the announcement. We need to take a good cynical eye on it and say, I need to stop back and think and follow up here. So is it in 2 years' time, has Amazon done what it promised? Because Amazon doesn't always follow through on commitments that it makes in this space.
Yeah, the timeline is in fact very long. Although, so one of the things they said, 100% renewable by 2030, which over 10 years, I think, is pretty fast considering when you're trying to run giant data centers, putting them onto renewable power, that seems like a really significant challenge. So if they can actually pull it off, kudos to them. Will they? I'm skeptical.
Yeah, well, take for example, I think Apple is 100% renewable energy now. Didn't they recently announce that they
I do not know. Yeah, and there's also issues with definitions. You know, what do you consider renewable? How are you justifying that? Does it mean you're doing some kind of offsets where you're still using, you know, natural gas or diesel at a data center, but providing offsets somewhere else, that kind of thing. So how this all gets measured is also very difficult to ascertain.
Yes. And, you know, so comparatively, Apple is not only has it got a very strong renewable energy policy, and I believe that Apple is actually already renewable, 100% renewable energy. Not necessarily sure. Yes, that's right. Apple has announced that all its global facilities are powered by 100% renewable energy. They're now going to their suppliers and bringing them on into renewable energy. So they're actually forcing their suppliers or encouraging their suppliers into renewable energy as well. And they've currently, in April, in their newsroom, they're saying we've got 44 suppliers currently running 100% clean energy. Apple will exceed its goal of bringing 4 gigawatts of renewable energy into the supply chain by 2020. So if you compare what Amazon's doing against Apple, it's like a bare minimum. It's an announcement and a plan that's going to take 20 years, and Apple is already doing it now. So I would say comparatively, not much of an effort.
Yes. Did you say that Apple has 4 gigawatts of renewable energy coming in? Okay.
Because no, that's just for their suppliers.
Just for their suppliers. Okay.
They're already 100% renewable energy for Apple itself, but now they've got 4 gigawatts from their suppliers.
Yeah. So TechCrunch had a story about the Amazon announcement and said that Amazon is working on 15 utility scale wind and solar renewable projects that will generate 1.3 gigawatts of capacity. So yeah, they are way behind then for if Apple's already at 4.
But not surprisingly, it's a nominal effort from Amazon, as is their want. Minimum effort for maximum press coverage, you know, maximum. Yeah.
Absolutely. This does smack of greenwashing. Although I do have to say when, you know, tech titans sort of go out publicly and make a big splash, you know, it's kind of like a holier than thou competition. So if Jeff Bezos being out there talking all green gets others to follow suit, I'm good with that. And let's hope it's actually real and not just a press release.
Yeah, I think what we've shown here is that it's a nice start. It's better than what they were doing last week, which was effectively nothing except from, you know, recycling cardboard or something, you know, or encouraging other people to do the work by using packaging.
Yeah.
You know, like it wasn't like Amazon was putting in the work the hard work to get suppliers to put in low carbon packaging.
Right.
You know, so this time it looks like Amazon's actually putting in some work, but it's a nominal effort by comparison.
Yes. And a slow time ramp as well. Mm. But again, at this point, I guess better than nothing.
Yeah.
So we've got links to the announcements if you want to go check it out, including Amazon's own webpage on what they're up to. All right, one more story. Chef is the latest tech company to find itself caught up in the tangle of activism versus profit. Apparently, a former Chef employee disrupted company operations by deleting code as a protest over Chef having a contract with the U.S. Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Chef CEO Barry Criss released a public letter stating that he has made, quote, a principled decision, unquote, to continue taking ICE's money.
There's not too much principles in there. He could just admit to what it is. You know, he's caught between a rock and a hard place, and he's got a responsibility to run a company, and there's no way out for the time being. We'll see what we can do. So basically, somebody on Twitter has outed Chef for taking a substantial amount of money, more than $100,000, from the Department of Homeland Security's and ICE. What's ICE again? Customs and
Immigration and Customs Enforcement, yeah.
Right. So that's the people who detain people as they come across the border and have formed up detention camps, or as some people would call them, concentration camps. And for some people, working on that type of organization is reprehensible, and you would be upset. And once this surfaced, somebody who was in the chef community, I believe, not necessarily a chef employee, it's a little hard to tell. It's all very happened in the last 24 hours. So I'm not going to get too far, but somebody decided that they would go into GitHub and delete their contributions to the project as part of a protest against that. Mm-hmm. And then GitHub suddenly decided to reinstate that code under their own name, which is definitely a no-no. Is it stealing code? Is it, you know, whatever? Because in theory, the person who wrote that has copyright and, you know, you should always keep the person's name against it, et cetera, et cetera. So that sort of ran into a bit of a blow up. I think it opens up the discussion that we've had several times on this show about, and the thing that I want to discuss is what happens when you're in that situation? What happens when the company you work for suddenly does, you know, maybe you're against Pentecostal churches of some way, and then your company suddenly has a contract to supply a cult-like church with technology support. Right. What's your position going to be, and how are you going to handle that situation?
Right.
And then this case, you know, the company's going to come out and say, we have to have the money. We've got a choice. We can either cancel it and walk away from a contract that they're legally obligated to supply, right? So, and if they walk away or change, it's going to take time to back out. It's going to be, you know, they're going to be on the hook to help make good somewhere or another. So there's, you have this situation. But the question here is going to be, is does the CEO of Chef make a decision because of the company's best interest or whatever? I think ultimately the letter that he published is very badly done, because it's not very principled at all. It's very unprincipled. It's, we're going to take the money. He didn't sort of say that there's a problem here and we're not sure how to handle it. So for now, we're going to just keep going on the path we're on and we'll see what we can do going forward, is what I would have said.
Yeah. So we've seen a lot of employee activism hitting tech companies. Google, you know, there suffered walkouts and internal uproar over some projects they were working on, including a reported sensor-friendly search engine, projects with the Department of Defense, that kind of thing, where internal protests essentially shut those projects down. I think the issue here is that it's Silicon Valley running into its own propaganda, where they position themselves as world-changing, friendly, happy, doing the right kind of thing people. And then when you actually run into ethical questions, you've got to decide, well, what are we? Are we what we say, or are we a business? Oracle doesn't have these kind of problems because Oracle has never positioned itself that way. They're out to make the money. And so that's who they are and that's what they do. They're not going to run into this kind of issue. Other tech companies who have positioned themselves as morally upstanding actors will have to wrestle significantly with this.
Right. And if you're an open source company, Chef is an open source company. They all their software is available and they act as a professional services organization. But part of being an open source company is that your product is partly built on contributions from other people.
That's a whole other tangle they're working on. Yeah.
Right. So yeah. If you form up and start taking on positions that object to the people who contribute to you, then, you know, there are consequences to making that decision.
So, there are, yes.
But on the flip side, you know, that wasn't a problem 5 years ago, but it is now. So
yeah, suddenly the risks of basing your business on open source software have become a little bit more tangled.
Yeah. I don't know if there's a good answer here, and I don't know. I think it's fair to say that Chef has handled this badly, but also the person who... I'm not going to give any names, but you can follow the links in the show notes to the Twitter posts that go around this and make your own decisions or assessments, or maybe follow up when we have more information next week. But it seems to me that Chef has not done very well here. And also the person involved, you know, just walking up and saying, I'm disgusted with this and deleting my code. Mind you, it did appear that they contacted Chef and Chef failed to respond or ignored their concerns. So I don't think there's any winners here. There's two sides to this argument, and I don't think there's a win-win.
It's a difficult situation. I'm not sure where I'm standing either.
At the end of the day, it's a duly elected government. It's got all the it can do what it can do these types of things. And your objection to it, you know, where do you play out your objections in that sphere? It's a tough one.
Yeah, it's a tough one. All right, well, that wraps up this episode. As Greg mentioned, we've got lots of links if you want to go check it out for yourself and form your own opinion. In the meantime, Greg, where can folks find you online?
At the moment, mostly getting upset at the UK name registrars. Apparently, a couple of years ago, they wandered up and decided that the .co.uk domain name wasn't the one that they wanted, and they wanted to move everybody to just .uk. Mm-hmm. And people didn't want to go and buy those domains. So 2 years ago, they decided to just give them those domain names. And now 2 years later, they're sending them invoices for them to resubscribe to those domain names. But they gave them away for free. And so there's a big foo-for-all happening in the UK where the name registrars are now attempting to send out invoices for domain names that people didn't register or didn't know about or didn't want. Mm-hmm. And extracting money. And what's turning into a bigger problem is that the people who were on the registrars who approved this process are also the people that own the companies who own the domain names who are doing the invoices. Mm. The committee, so there's this real corruption sort of stink coming off this. So I'm watching that. I haven't raised that here, but if you are getting invoices for your .co.uk and .uk domain names, you might want to look very carefully as to whether they are something that you want, because they gave them to you for free and now they're billing them to you.
Yeah, that's something we can keep an eye on for the next show. And speaking of the next show, by the way, we have a follow-up option if you want to send us a correction or a comment on anything we talked about. It's at packetpushers.net/FU. FU stands for follow-up. If you're willing, we'll report on your follow-up because we want to make sure we get things right. And we're also happy to hear your opinion. So if you want to leave a comment, we'd love to hear it. All right. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, tell other people, leave a recommendation on Apple Podcasts, or just spread the word. That really helps us. Thank you for listening.